It's the Philosopher's Zone summer, and we revisit kids and reading. Can reading as a kid make you a better grown-up? Well, a Cambridge philosopher has found a deep moral lesson in a surprising place. Not Plato, not Wittgenstein, but Enid Blyton.
A great many of the books left me feeling racked with guilt because I kept identifying with the least sympathetic characters, the ones who were a little bit lazy, the ones who were bad at sport. So I think I was quite aware from the start that there was a great deal of judgment built into the way those books were written. You can use a kind of a jargony term and say that books are really about the threat of solipsism, but solipsism here isn't some kind of odd philosophical position. It's more a temptation to which we're all subject, to be self-centered, to be narcissistic, and forget that the world looks a certain way to other people.
A moral lesson courtesy of an Enid Blyton classic. And later, we'll go on the road to test whether reading just any children's book can make you more moral.
So if you guys had an invisibility cloak, what would you do?
I would start throwing cakes in from the bakery at everyone. Because it would be fun.
But you wouldn't like it if I threw a pie at you right now.
Of course I would.
Maybe I would. Yes. Delicious.
So, Eleanor Gordon-Smith, who is that Cambridge philosopher and what's he doing with Enid Blyton?
It's a good question. This year marks 75 years of Enid Blyton's Famous Five, and she's not much in vogue these days. Some are downright against her work, and you've probably seen those snarky spoofs like Five Go Gluten-Free. But her writing still resonates with one academic.
Hello, I'm Nakul Krishna. I am an unestablished lecturer at the University of Cambridge.
Nakul's favourite Blyton series is Mallory Towers. It's a classic set in a girls' boarding school, the kind of thing you read at a beach house. But Nakul thinks there's a profound moral lesson in there. And as we'll hear, he's been able to put it to use in his own life.
I think that it's never been just holiday fun, in part because it's so clear from the sorts of plots that Enid Blyton has in those books that there's a great deal more happening. Characters are always saying these things to each other that have this quite explicit moral content. They're calling each other things like spiteful or pious or greedy or lazy. All of these are moral judgments, right? They're ways of describing each other in terms of virtues and vices. So right from the beginning, it's fairly clear to me that I think the big purpose of the book is just as much didactic. It's to teach a lesson, but in a way that's bundled up with a great deal of fun and lacrosse games and descriptions of midnight feasts.
Was that something that you realised when you read it for the first time?
Yes and no. I suppose I wouldn't have put it that way. I must have been maybe 11 or 12 when I read it, and like, as I've discovered, a great many other boys who have been great fans of it for the last 50 or so years, I read it because they were on my sister's bookshelves, and I read it very, very discreetly and didn't let anyone know. And this turns out to be true of a great many other boys. Yeah, so I wouldn't at that stage have put it quite as I did just now, but I think I was aware that there was more going on than fun for the simple reason that a great many of the books left me feeling racked with guilt because I kept identifying with the least sympathetic characters, the ones who were a little bit lazy, the ones who were bad at sport, the ones who were just a bit sort of arty, and these were things that weren't terribly good things to be at Mallory Towers. So I think I was quite aware from the start that there was a great deal of judgment built into the way those books were written. It's a book that's telling you that the world is actually full of fun and you shouldn't be so full of yourself that you don't see the worth of joining in with other people. Even things like sport, which some people can find alienating, as we well know, turn out to be things that you don't have to be very good at. But what matters is that you're willing to put in, you know, the best that you can do. And I think that's a really positive message at that stage, when I realised quite early on that I never was going to be a sporting hero. But it did tell me that sport could be fun. It didn't have to be this horrible competitive thing.
Was there a particular scene that made that clear for you?
Yes, I think it's a description in of a lacrosse game, which is a game that I didn't really know the rules of except for the description in the books. And there's a scene where a character sprains her ankle in the middle of a game, And there's a moment where it's half time and they're saying, can you go on? And she says, yes, I can. And someone gives her a lemon. She stands on her feet. She puts her weight on it. And she says, yeah, I'm going to carry through the rest of the game. And it seemed to me then that this whole lacrosse game, which is a quite minor episode, playing lacrosse against a rival school, became this kind of epic event where characters are going to be tested to the utmost of their limits. And I think I got into the drama of it quite thoroughly. So for me, it was never just about lacrosse, just about sporting victory. It was a place where character was tested, which is exactly the kind of idea that the great 19th century Victorian headmasters of boarding schools had in mind when they made such a big deal of sport.
Enid Blyton has turned out over 150 books since she wrote her first. Let's hope there'll be plenty more to delight the children and help their mothers and grandmothers and aunts to solve the birthday present problem.
I had two brothers who were younger than I was, and I used to tell them stories. But I also knew I didn't know nearly enough about children to be able to put over things like good morals. So I decided that I would run my own school. I ran it for 4 or 5 years, and in that time I wrote absolutely everything for the children.
Is there a particular character that stands out in the Blyton canon as someone who you really don't want to be?
Yes, and there's a very simple answer to that. There's a character in the Mallory Towers books called Gwendolyn Mary Lacey, and she always insists on that middle name, which is already a bad sign. From the very first book onwards, she's seen at the railway station making a huge fuss about being sent off to boarding school, weeping rather theatrically, and her mother and her governess are both there, sort of hugging and kissing her, and both of them are these rather sort of weak-willed people who seem to have pampered her thoroughly. And the sign of this fact is that they wear too many scarves, even though it's at the end of summer. So she's the kind of character who, over the course of the books, reveals herself as having pretty much every vice you can have in the Blyton universe. She's spiteful, she's malicious, she's lazy, she's untalented but doesn't have the honesty to admit to herself that there are some things she's not very good at. And just the constant mendacity where she doesn't let on that she ever sees just how bad she is at these things. So over the course of the books, you keep seeing her being given chances to mend her ways. People point out her vices, people do it kindly, people do it sometimes more cruelly, but she never sees it. So right at the beginning, I was terrified that deep down I really was a Gwendolyn, and a huge deal of my efforts at self-cultivation in my childhood were aimed at not being a Gwendolyn.
Do you think you've won that battle?
I hope so. I sincerely hope so. I'm never going to be any good at lacrosse or any other sport, but I hope I'm not spiteful or self-deceived in the way that she was.
So you have a kind of broader idea about a uniting moral lesson in the Blyton universe about empathy. Walk me through what that is.
I think the central theme of the books, when they're dealing with the more admirable characters like the heroine Daryl, as well as the character Gwendolyn, whom I just mentioned, the more spiteful and malevolent ones, I think both of these sets of characters are depicted as faced with the same kind of temptation, namely the temptation to forget that other people exist and have completely real mental lives of their own. You can use a kind of a jargony term and say that books are really about the threat of solipsism, but solipsism here isn't some kind of odd philosophical position. It's more a temptation to which we're all subject, to be self-centered, to be narcissistic, and forget that the world looks a certain way to other people. So the big message I think you get over the course of the books is that the threat of this lapse into self-centeredness is something that we're constantly faced with, and there's never a point at which you're just cured of the problem. So the books, in their depictions of these girls at a boarding school playing lacrosse, having secret midnight feasts, working out whether they need to sneak on a friend of theirs to a teacher or not, each of these are dilemmas that they're faced with that really come down to the question of whether they're taking seriously the fact that they inhabit a world that's also populated by other people, people who are just as real as oneself. And I think the clearest sign of this is that the biggest punishment, the worst punishment that the girls can impose on each other is being sent to Coventry, where you're ostracized from the company of your fellows. No one speaks to you until you make some kind of gesture that says, I acknowledge the wrong that I've done and I want to be admitted to society again. I think that's the clearest sign that this is a place where judgment is not the judgment of some god or of some impersonal law. It's the judgment of the people one inhabits a world with.
Do you think that's a kind of serious moral lesson that we can learn from as adults as well?
I think that's right. I think there's a great temptation in contemporary culture, certainly in the last 50 or 60 years, where, for instance, hear of politicians caught out in a scandal, then saying that what they're doing after the scandal is not so much trying to make amends for the wrong they did, but trying to sort of realize that they love themselves deep down after all. And the kind of figure who comes in here is that of the therapist, someone who's telling you to be strong and to love yourself. And I think what these books tell you is that maybe that's one half of the picture. Maybe it is valuable to love yourself. But if when that self-love comes at the expense of this kind of callousness, then something's gone wrong. So I think what we can learn from it is that it's not a bad thing to find your own self-conception and self-image depending, at least in part, on how other people judge you. I think it's a valuable lesson to learn that part of who we are just is how other people think of us, and we shouldn't want to be in a world where the only thing that matters is the way we judge ourselves. I think there's too much threat of self-deception when we leave ourselves in the hands of our own judgments. We're just too liable to be self-forgiving, and it's valuable to have other people's judgment come in and inform our picture of ourselves.
Right, and the Blighton girls seem to flourish when they incorporate other people's views into their own view.
I think that's exactly right. Time and again, I think you have characters, even the more sympathetic ones, who find themselves losing their temper or doing something petty because they're jealous of the fact that their friend seems to be playing lacrosse with a different girl. And those are moments at which I think they find it most valuable to realise that the world doesn't revolve around you. There are other people around, and they have their own lives, their projects, their concerns. And the way of being a good friend is to respect that.
What do you think Enid Blyton herself would think if she heard us talking about her as a moral educator? Was that something that she ever explicitly wanted to do?
I believe it was. I think one thing she didn't like was criticism. I think she once said something like, "I don't care about the criticism of any critic over the age of 12. But I think she was very conscious of the fact that she was educating her readers. So there's a certain number of lessons. One of them that I mentioned just now, this idea that what matters most is that we acknowledge how other people are real and matter. But something else, I think, which comes into a number of her other books, even the more light-hearted adventure stories, is, I think, animals, caring for animals, particularly dogs. I mean, I worry sometimes that that just is a kind of English fetish, the sense of the love of dogs being this very, very deep fact about someone. And I'm sure that you can be a perfectly decent person while not liking dogs. But I do think the sign of cruelty to animals can be a sign that something is deeply wrong. The sense that when you're faced with a vulnerable being, you don't quite see it as having claims on you. And I think that can mean a great deal for the way in which you see other human beings.
Do you think that there's anything special for you and your experience reading Enid Blyton in the fact that it's such a girl-heavy atmosphere?
Oh, the Mallory Towers books are girl-heavy, not so much the adventure stories, which are, if anything, quite patriarchal. There's always these alpha male teenage boys called Julian or Dick. But the Mallory Towers books in particular, I think, I read before I had a particularly strong or explicit consciousness that they were for girls. I suppose I was well enough aware of them that I realised it was best not to be seen reading them in public. But I got the sense that the way in which the girls were depicted wasn't in any way that I recognised then as being objectionably girly. They were people who were doing these quite boyish things like sport, at least stereotypically boyish things like sport, and the kinds of emotions they had, the kinds of problems they had in their relationships with their fellows and with authority, mirrored exactly my own experiences. So I suppose if they taught me a lesson, it was that really, girls weren't all that much unlike boys. They suffered from the same problems, they experienced the world in roughly similar ways, and they took pleasure in the same things.
I wonder if that's a kind of a foundation for a way in which reading more generally can be a kind of moral education, to learn that we're not so far from the people that we read about.
That sounds exactly right. I think the fact that you're not so much told, it's not simply asserted to you that other people are like you, you're allowed to see it and recognise the ways in which other people are like you. And once you inhabit the world and spend so much time with a bunch of characters, it becomes harder and harder for you to pretend that they are fundamentally different.
In the Philosopher's Zone, Nakul Krishna on the moral lessons in the works of Enid Blyton. He's been talking to Eleanor Gordon-Smith.
So far, we've heard the thought that the moral lesson in Blyton is that we should take other people seriously. That's a powerful thought and a philosophical one, because there are a lot of ethicists who think that immorality just is a failure of empathy or a failure to see other people as real. Iris Murdoch is one. She thought the central task of the moral life is to truly see others as real. But then there are a lot of writers who say that that's exactly what reading teaches us, to see other people as real. Jonathan Franzen talks about fiction as a way to get off an existential island, and Virginia Woolf talks about reading as a union with another mind. So after talking to Narkul, I started to think, if morality is about seeing others as real, and reading is a way to do that, could reading anything as a child be a moral education, just as reading Blighton is? I went to the coalface of kids fiction to find out.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can do a Hermione impression. Have you seen a toad? A boy called Neville's lost it. Oh, are you doing magic? Let's see then. Well, it isn't very good, is it? I know a few simple spells myself, but they all work for me.
These are some students at Darlinghurst Public School in Sydney, and you just heard an uncanny impression of Hermione Granger from the Harry Potter series. Harry Potter turns out to be a good starting point for an investigation into whether reading makes you moral, because at one point, Harry gets an invisibility cloak. And what tests a moral compass better than not being seen? So if you guys had an invisibility cloak, what would you do?
I would start throwing cakes in from the bakery at everyone.
It'd Why? Be,
because it would be fun.
That's not very nice.
But sometimes doing not very nice things can be quite funny.
If I had an invisibility cloak, I would just walk everywhere and try and trip people over, because that would be really funny, because they'd just be like walking down the street, then I would trip them and they would fall and they'd be like, what happened? I'd also probably do some pie throwing. That would be fun.
Someone explain the pie thing to me. Why do we like pie mischief so much?
Because it messes up people's faces and they get really angry and they look funny, like the boogie monster.
And it's not that bad because they can just lick it off.
Also, I love eating pie, so I wouldn't get mad at someone if they threw a pie in my face.
Okay, I want to go back to the stealing lollies thing, because we had two big things that you guys would do with invisibility clothes. One is chuck pies, one is steal lollies. I get the pie thing, but why are we going to steal lollies?
Because they're delicious.
But you should pay for them.
What's better than lollies that you actually buy from a convenience store? Free lollies.
So do you think there's a sense in which whatever we read as kids could shape our empathy or our moral reasoning as grown-ups?
Well, I'm sure it does. I would be wary of making too strong a claim for this. I don't think there's any strict way in which one can control what effects the reading of fiction has. It's, I think, well-known fact that one set of people that do have a lot of empathy in a narrow sense are sadists, or people who do need to be able to put themselves into the shoes of someone else so that they can inflict more pain on them.
To understand what hurts, right?
That's exactly right. So I suppose it isn't enough simply to have empathy. It's got to be combined with some further disposition to be aware of other people's pain and then to care about preventing it or to care about not causing it. And there's no guarantee that one will get from this kind of psychological sensitivity to this kind of concern. I suppose it is possible that someone could read books like Mallory Towers and come out actually quite identifying with Gwendolyn and being quite unashamed of it. So we shouldn't expect there to be any predictable pattern of moral formation that comes out of reading fiction. But in a way, I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for there to be a form of moral education that doesn't try to control people in their entirety. I think it's a way of throwing out some possibilities, showing you that here are some ways in which you can live life, here are some admirable qualities, here are some ways in which it's possible to look at people. And so I think if we look at fiction as opening up a space of possibilities, pointing out what can be done, what kind of person one can be, as opposed to what kind of person one must or ought to be, I think as long as we're open to that kind of freedom and unpredictability, I think fiction can be a very valuable part of how we shape ourselves and our children.
Right, and it can, I guess in that sense, be less didactic. I mean, it's not like an Aesop's fable or a really clear kind of moral story where the kid does something bad and then gets its fingers cut off by a mythical demon. You know, it's more subtle as a kind of moral education.
I think that's precisely right. And that's certainly true of a great deal of adult fiction, the sort of 19th century realist fiction that serious readers of fiction, people who make strong claims for the moral value of fiction, are things like Henry James and so forth, right? These very rich psychological descriptions. But it seems to me that you can have something that's somewhere between the kind of endless complexity and psychological subtlety of a Henry James on the one hand and the somewhat simple-minded, fable-like character of an Aesop's fable. You've got something in the middle where you have a bunch of characters who are archetypes. Their psychologies are simple, but there's still more complexity in them. These characters aren't interchangeable. They're not just symbolic of certain character types. They have a very real kind of existence. And I think as such, we oughtn't to patronize the sorts of stories that lie between these two extremes. I think they're extremely valuable precisely because they have both these elements of archetype on the one hand and these kinds of psychological subtlety on the other.
Do you think there's much hope for those of us who grew up on the novels of Roald Dahl that kind of just seem to teach you that parents have to be dead if there's to be any fun?
I suppose Roald Dahl comes with an opposite set of risks. The moral message there, if there is one, is very much the one you've mentioned. It's one that's rather patronizing towards grown-ups and rather tends to celebrate the kinds of kids who are naughty. And it's very much not pious about causing pain. It seems to take a kind of dubious relish in the sorts of mischief which do cause pain.
Yeah, so I learned from Danny, the champion of the world, that if you want to choke a rich man's car, you should put sugar in the petrol tank.
Right. So they also have a great deal of rather dangerous practical advice for how to cause the most damage. I myself am not a fan of Roald Dahl for possibly these reasons. Maybe I ended up being a rather priggish child as a result of my early immersion in the works of Blyton. But I wouldn't go too far in that direction. I'd say that both Enid Blyton and Roald Dahl share one thing in common, which is the idea that the world isn't there simply so that there can be morality and goodness and duty. The world is a place of enormous fun. And the fact that so much of these books consists in descriptions of just the physical pleasure of being in the world, of swimming, of taking long walks, of eating sweets, and these rather grim-sounding foods that they have at midnight feasts out of cans. So in that sense, I think it's a good thing to teach children that the world is a place of fun and pleasure, and it's not a bad thing to pursue pleasure. Things only go wrong when that pleasure comes at the cost of other people, when it comes as a result of callousness, when your pleasure is a form of selfishness. That's when something started to go wrong. But there's nothing wrong in pleasure as such, and I think works which celebrate that fact are to be commended.
Do you think that you've managed to hang on to any of these childlike lessons in your adulthood or any of that sense of fun?
I hope so. There were very particular things that I think Mallory Towers brought about in my life, and one of them was it forced me to learn to swim, something I was too timid to do as a child, and I resisted swimming lessons for years. But there's a quite vivid description of this outdoor swimming pool in Mallory Towers, and the kinds of description that are given of these children taking so much pleasure in this outdoor swimming pool made me, at the ripe old age of 23, finally take swimming lessons. And over the last 5 or 6 years, I think it's been one of the biggest sources of pleasure in my life, the fact that I learned to swim. And every time I'm in an outdoor swimming pool, I'm always thinking of how it falls short of what is almost the ideal swimming pool, namely the one that the girls had in Mallory Towers.
Nakul Krishna of Cambridge University casts an adult eye over the books he read as a child, talking to Eleanor Gordon-Smith. As for ethical experiments with invisibility cloaks and the like, you can't go past Short and Curly, a whole podcast series devoted to kids working out what's what. And there's one episode just on that topic of being invisible. Short and Curly. Thanks today to Eleanor Gordon-Smith and to Diane Dean and Andrei Shabanov for this first summer edition of The Philosopher's Zone.
I should say the most important quality I possess is my ability to get right to the hearts of children and enable them to see things in the right way. I don't really know how I get to the hearts of children. I only know that I love them. I want them to grow up into good, decent grown-ups. I want them to be kind and loving and generous. That sounds, of course, very pious, but it isn't pious. It's simply and solely what every single mother really in her heart of hearts wants for her own child. And I just happen to want it for all children. That's all.